course you have a choice.
We don't. We have a serious problem, Jimmy, and if we don't get to the bottom of it, the results could be catastrophic.
The results could be catastrophic?
Jimmy turned to Philip.
They're talking to me about catastrophic results.
Philip shrugged. Jimmy looked directly into Britt the Elder's eyes.
I killed a town. A town. Every man, woman, and child in an entire town dead because I was monkeying around in people's code and made a mistake. There's no way I'm ever gonna do that again.
Britt the Much Elder said, We're not going to ask you to make any changes to anyone's code. We're just going to explore the code to see if we can figure out exactly what's going on and hopefully find a safe way to fix it. We were hoping you could share with us anything you learned to help guide us. And we're not going to be looking at the code of any large groups of people. Our explorations will be restricted to one person.
Who?
Britt the Elder said.
Me.
Jimmy looked at Britt the Elder, then at Britt the Much Elder, then at Philip, who shook his head. Jimmy turned back to Britt the Elder.
You?
Yes.
You are literally the only person I know of who isn't just one person. I've got two of you sitting here on my couch right now. Who knows how many more of you there are?
I know of at least one,
Philip said. But we won't be doing this to her, Britt the Elder said.
Yet,
Philip muttered. Britt the Elder kicked off one of her crocs, raised her leg up in front of Jimmy's face, and let him watch as her foot phased between its normal and low polygon versions.
See, she asked. See why we're willing to risk it? I've got an error and it's getting worse. There's no way to know when it'll get so bad that my file gets permanently corrupted, or the whole program crashes. We need to get this fixed, for everybody's good, and you're the only person we know of who's ever dug that deep into a living person's code.
Jimmy leaned back in his chair and thought silently for several seconds. Britt the Elder pulled her croc back on.
Will you help us or not? You've put me in a tough spot. Whether or not I help you monkey with your file listing, it'll probably end badly. What part do you want to explore?
The part of the file listing that deals with memory. Do you know anything about it?
I do.
Good.
No, it's not. It's a minefield that's been planted inside your own brain. And now, if I refuse to help you and you make some tragic mistake, it's my fault for not sharing what I know. But if I do help you poke around in your own skull and we make a mistake, which is almost inevitable, I'll be blamed for not knowing what I'm doing, and Philip here will almost certainly claim I did it on purpose.
That's true,
Philip agreed. Britt the Much Elder said,
You missed a possible outcome. If you don't help us and her glitch brings down the whole program, then you're just as dead as the rest of us.
Jimmy thought for another moment.
Yeah, I see your point. Okay, look, I'll show you everything I know, and I'll help you map out and explore the part of the file that deals with memories, but I won't be a party to making any changes to your or anyone else's brain. Hopefully you'll see how foolhardy and dangerous this all is and decide to come up with a better idea. Deal?
Deal, both Brits said. Philip groaned. Jimmy sprung up from his chair.
Great! I gotta tell you, despite the awful reason for it happening, it feels good to have company and be working with people who know what's going on again. Say, how about before we get started, we all get dinner to celebrate? You could take in some local color. A genuine taste of Reno. No place on earth does mediocrity better. Down at the Nugget, they've got a burger called the Awful Awful.
Philip sighed.
Sounds appropriate.
18. The mid-morning light of a fresh new day in Leadchurch didn't so much cascade in through the windows of Philip's rec room as it tumbled in reluctantly and hit the floor in a chilly, flat gray heap. Outside, an unbroken ceiling of clouds drizzled chilled water. Inside, all the lights were off, and the curtains were drawn just enough to let light in but send the message that the light was not welcome, and had better mind its manners. The room's original entrance and exit was the staircase that led down to Philip's seance room and storefront. But in the time since Philip remodeled, he had added two doors. One was a large wall panel that lowered like a drawbridge, designed to allow Philip to drive his beloved Pontiac Fiero in and out, which he rarely did. The other was a simple wooden door set into the wall on the opposite end of the long rectangular room. This door was linked magically to Britt the Younger's apartment in Atlantis. It was the small door to Atlantis that creaked open, allowing in yet more light, a bleary-eyed Philip, and the sound of a conversation that was already in progress.
"No," Philip said. "I just didn't sleep well."
Nick's distant voice drifted in.
"I could make you some tea."
"No, thank you, Nick. I have it handled, thanks."
He shut the door behind him, and instantly his body sagged. For a moment he stood there, breathing and listening to the silence. This room was full of items Philip had hand-picked to make himself happy, but he took no notice of any of them, not even glancing at anything beyond the wet bar. He reached for a coffee mug and an empty diner-grade coffee carafe to which he'd applied one of his better macros. He tipped it over the rim of the mug, and freshly brewed steaming hot coffee poured out into the mug. Philip stared down at the mug long enough to take two heaving breaths, blinked so slowly it almost counted as a nap, then muttered,
"Why not?"
He reached for a bottle of scotch and poured a shot into his coffee. He spent about 5 minutes standing there behind the bar in his darkened rec room, eyes closed, drinking his spiked coffee in silence. When the mug was empty, he set it aside and, with Herculean effort, took the 3 steps back to the door to Britt's apartment. He gathered his energy, stood up straight, and opened the door.
"Okay, Britt," he said cheerily. "I'm almost ready to go on that walk we discussed. I just need to visit the loo first."
Britt's voice was distant, but easily understandable.
"Actually, dear, I've decided not to come along."
Philip stepped into Britt the Younger's apartment and pushed the door closed behind him.
"Oh, in that case, I suppose I'll just go get it over with. The sooner I start, the sooner I'll be back with you, after all."
As the door swung shut, Britt said,
"But I thought you had to go to the bathroom." At the same time, Nick called out, "Oh, and while you're out, can you please get me?"
The door closed with a thud, and the room fell back into silence. The haggard-looking future Philip leaned out from his hiding spot behind the Gorf machine and scanned the room, making sure present Philip was truly gone. Convinced that this was the case, he turned to the large, empty space where Philip's Fiero usually sat.
"He didn't even notice,"
future Philip said.
"All that trouble to steal my own car, and he didn't even notice. I figured he'd spend the rest of the day looking for it."
Martin said,
"He seemed pretty distracted."
Future Philip jumped and spun around to see Martin's eyes and hat poking up from behind the bar.
"I wouldn't judge him too harshly. Neither of you noticed that I was hiding down here."
Future Philip snarled,
"What are you doing here?"
Martin held up one finger, asking for Philip to wait a second. Martin turned and moved forward in small lurches, raising a few inches with each step, making it look as if he was walking up a staircase behind the bar. When he was standing fully upright, he said,
"I love that gag."
"Yes,"
Philip said.
"Hilarious. Now what are you doing here?"
"Watching you? I've been watching you for a while now. I watched you while you stalked Philip, current Philip, when he was out for a walk with Britt, current Britt, yesterday. I watched you lurk outside their home all night. I followed and watched as you snuck into Philip's most private personal space. I saw it all, and a disgusting sight it was."
"You did all of those things too."
"Yes, but you did them to spy on Philip and interfere with his life. I did them to protect Philip and keep tabs on you."
"I am Philip."
"Sometimes a friend needs to be protected from themselves. And I didn't steal his car."
Philip pointed out the window.
"I was just trying to distract him. The Fiero's just outside, hidden under a haystack. I can have it back in here in less than a minute."
"Then I suggest you get to it."
Future Philip sneered at Martin.
"It didn't work anyway."
He pointed his staff at the large drawbridge door set into the wall, but nothing happened. He tried again, with the same result. Martin snapped his fingers.
"Oh, that's right. While I was waiting under the bar, I set up a zone around you where no magic can work."
Philip's eyes grew wide, and he blurted,
"Transporto Hishmu!"
Nothing happened. Martin smiled.
"Yeah. Inside an 8-foot box, there in that corner of the room, you can't do magic."
"An 8-foot box?"
future Philip asked.
"Yes."
"Right.
Future Philip took two determined-looking steps, then slammed headfirst into an invisible wall. Martin came out from behind the bar and stepped closer to Philip.
I also put up force fields to keep you from leaving the area where you can't do magic. Sorry, but I need to keep you from interfering with Philip until I figure out what exactly is going on.
You know what's going on! I told you what's going on!
And now I'll be able to verify it.
You're just enjoying acting like a jerk, aren't you, Martin?
Look who's talking! You're the one who stole a man's car!
It's my car, and I only did it to distract him. You know what, though? I can still get his attention. I'd hope to avoid this, but you forced my hand. All I have to do is yell loud enough, and they'll hear me in there.
He pointed at the door to Britt the Younger's apartment.
Philip will come running, and he'll see me, and that I'm him, and that you have him, i.e. me, trapped. That'll distract him.
Philip's gone for a walk.
Then Britt and Nick will hear it, find us, call Philip, and it'll be an even bigger distraction.
Martin shook his head.
You can't do that.
Philip said, watch me, and opened his mouth to shout. Martin touched the head of his staff to the force field that held Philip in place and said, mute. Philip shouted, but no sound came out. He shouted again, louder, but with the same result. No sound at all. He extended his index finger as if he intended to give Martin a piece of his mind, or poke him in the eye, or probably both. He took one step and ran into the invisible wall again. He let go of his staff and used both hands to explore the invisible wall by feel. It extended several feet on each side before bending at 90 degrees, completely enveloping him. Future Philip bellowed at Martin with all of his might, but couldn't make a sound.
"You like it?"
Martin asked.
It's a macro I've been working on in my spare time. I call it the Mime Box. I was saving it for after Gary did something really over the line to one of us, which I figure is only a matter of time. I wanted to hold it for something special because being trapped and forced to act like a mime is pretty much the worst non-injuring punishment I can think of.
Philip pounded on the invisible wall and screamed, but no sound was audible. Martin said,
I see you agree.
19.
So, notice this number here,
Jimmy said. He leaned forward and touched the computer monitor with his index finger. He was sitting in the office Philip and Britt the Elder had inhabited, at the workstation Philip had used to sift through the Atlantis magic logs. Britt the Elder and Britt the Much Elder flanked Jimmy in rolling office chairs, watching over his shoulders in rapt attention as he walked them through Britt the Elder's own file entry. Philip stood at the opposite end of the room, peering out through the blinds in the window, trying not to listen to the sound of Jimmy explaining, or the Brits being nice to him.
When I hit refresh, notice how that number goes up. Every time I hit refresh, it goes up some more.
Is it counting refreshes somehow? Britt the Much Elder asked.
I wondered that too, but if I wait a while between refreshes, it doesn't just go up one or two counts. Over time, I figured out that this number progresses at a steady rate, whether I'm looking at it or not.
Britt the Elder said, like a clock.
Exactly like a clock.
Philip looked out at the parking lot. He could see a nondescript dark blue four-door with the figures of two men in the front seat barely visible through the foggy windshield.
Seems like the nice thing to do would have been to give Miller and Murphy a few days off while Jimmy's in your custody.
Britt the Much Elder said, yeah, probably. But Miller's a real pain in the butt, and Murphy enables him. At least I let them take a flight out here. I could have made them drive out from Reno. Britt the Elder cleared her throat.
You were saying, Jimmy?
Yes, of course. So, you've got this number that acts like a clock. Keep that in mind. Now we're going to scroll down to another spot in your file entry.
Philip continued peering out the window. He didn't find the parking lot of a federal building in Sacramento particularly interesting, but he found what was going on in the room interesting to the point of horrified fascination, in much the same way a condemned man finds the topic of capital punishment interesting. He was desperate to think about anything else, and the window was his only refuge. Jimmy continued.
Now here you'll see a call-out. The code is sending some piece of information to another part of the program. That's nothing strange. A person's file is full of them. The file's nothing but a data store, after all. A silo where they hold all the facts, figures, and describable parameters that make you, you, and not someone else. But this call-out is different. Do you see how?
Britt the Elder said, "It's not calling out to the program. It's calling out to another part of the file."
Philip said,
"I just feel bad for them, Miller and Murphy, sitting in that car, watching the building with nobody but each other for company. From what I've heard, they aren't very good company."
"Actually, they can be a lot of fun," Jimmy said. "And don't feel too bad. They're happier when they can keep an eye on me. Well, I don't think happier is the word, really."
"More comfortable," Britt the Much Elder offered.
"No, that's not it either. But they're definitely less happy and less comfortable when they're not watching me. It's like the unhappiness of watching me makes them happier. There isn't really a word for that."
"I bet the Germans have one."
"Yeah," Jimmy said, "and specific nightclubs where you can go to feel it."
Britt the Elder had taken little notice and no joy in the conversation, both quite deliberately. "Can we please get back to business?"
"Of course," Jimmy said. "If we go to the portion of the file it specifies, you'll see that it's in the middle of this weird sea of numbers, commas, and colons. We never really paid that much attention to it because nobody had any idea what it was or how to find out. But if you go to the exact point your file entry specified, you'll see it's made up of a long chain of three number sets. I figure the middle number in each set is the address of a location in some other file, one we haven't found, and frankly, I don't think we should look for it. The first and last numbers, though, they match the formatting exactly of the number I just showed you."
"It's a timestamp," Britt the Elder said.
"I believe so. I believe that we're looking at the filing information for your long-term memories. The first and last number show the beginning and endpoints of the experience you'll remember, and the middle number is its name or location or some such."
Britt the Much Elder said, "A set of numbers was just added to the list."
Jimmy said, "Yep.
Who knows? That could be you storing away the moment you realized how your long-term memory works. A fairly memorable experience, I'd say."
Philip said,
"This is just wrong."
"Hey, I'm with you, Philip. I didn't even want to show you all this. I don't like that I know it myself. But all I'm doing is sharing the knowledge," Jimmy replied.
"What? No, not that. It's not right that we're treating Miller and Murphy this way. They're just doing their jobs. We should send them a pizza or something."
"No," Britt the Much Elder said. "They'd only take it as taunting. It'd just make them angry."
"Everything makes Miller angry,"
Jimmy muttered. Britt the Much Elder laughed. "True enough. No, Philip, you're sweet, but it's best just to leave them be. They're professionals, and they volunteered for this duty." Jimmy smiled.
"Besides, if they're hungry, they can just eat the banana that's in their tailpipe."
Britt the Much Elder looked aghast.
"Still?"
"The macro follows them, not the car they had in Reno. Until I make it stop, every car Miller attempts to drive for the rest of his days will have a foggy windshield and a banana in its tailpipe, and the car will stall even though the banana trick doesn't work."
Britt the Much Elder laughed again and hit Jimmy on the shoulder playfully.
"You're so bad!"
Philip and Britt the Elder both scowled at them, but for different reasons. Philip didn't know what he liked less, being called sweet, the sight of Britt, any Britt, laughing at Jimmy's jokes, or the prospect of Britt the Elder tinkering with her own long-term memories. Britt the Elder was just impatient to get back to work.
"So what happens if you delete one of the entries?"
"I don't know," Jimmy said.
"What do you mean, you don't know?"
"I never tried. Or at least if I did, I must erase the memory of me trying."
Britt the Much Elder laughed. Philip did not.
"Seriously," Jimmy said, "I wouldn't touch any of these numbers with a 10-foot pole. No way, no how. Too dangerous."
"I don't see where we have another option."
"And I don't see where this is an option to begin with. Britt, I only agreed to show this to you because I figured you'd see how vague and uncertain it is and you'd decide to try something else."
Britt the Elder shook her head.
"There is nothing else to try. It's this or do nothing."
Britt the Much Elder put a hand on Britt the Elder's shoulder, but she squirmed out from under it immediately.
"Don't touch me."
Britt the Much Elder said, "I'm just trying to calm you down."
"Don't touch me because you're me. I won't even be in the same room with Britt the Younger for fear of a world-ending glitch. I came to you without thinking, and I've kept you involved because it didn't seem to hurt anything, but we shouldn't press our luck.
And in case you all need a reminder, that's what we're talking about. Trying to prevent the entire known universe from blinking out and being replaced with a bong noise and a little drawing of an old-timey bomb.
Jimmy squinted and cocked his head to the side.
Philip said, "She uses an original Mac."
Jimmy nodded.
"What do you suggest?" Britt the much elder asked. "That we just start erasing numbers willy-nilly to see how it affects you and by extension me?"
Britt the elder rolled her eyes.
"No, obviously not. We would carefully analyze the situation, handpick certain specific numbers of interest, then copy and delete them in a sober, cautious manner and see how it affects us."
Philip shut his eyes so hard it almost hurt.
"It's tempting to try it just to make you forget that Jimmy ever told you about this."
Britt the elder said, "Listen, the problem started when my and Britt the younger's memories diverged, right? Her memory seemed to match reality, mine don't. I think the most logical course of action, given what we've learned from Jimmy, is to find my memories that are different from hers and swap them out."
Jimmy pushed back from the keyboard.
"I'm sorry, everyone. Britt's problem's worse than we thought. In addition to her other memory issues, she seems to have forgotten what logic is.
Look, Britt, I understand that you're under a lot of stress here, but we don't know nearly enough about any of this to even consider erasing any of these numbers. Even if we're right and these are long-term memories, and we don't know how they interact with the rest of your cognitive processes. Any number of vital subroutines could refer back to these memories on a regular basis. Anything you learn probably needs to refer back to this. Language use, pattern recognition, emotional responses to given situations or people. It's all tied into memory. So, no. I'm not going to be a party to changing any of this stuff unless we do a lot of careful testing first."
"Damn right!"
Philip shouted.
Britt the elder glared at Philip.
"You realize you're siding with Jimmy, your worst enemy, over me?"
Jimmy said,
"I'd rather you called me his greatest enemy instead of his worst. Worst implies low quality. You could argue that Gary's his worst enemy."
Philip said,
"Gary's my friend."
Which shows how bad at being an enemy he really is.
Britt the much elder said,
"Jimmy, now's not the time. Philip, there's no need to yell. And Britt, Philip's not siding with Jimmy. Philip and I are siding with Jimmy. Without careful testing, it's just way too dangerous to even consider changing any of those numbers."
"You're all being silly. Think about it." Britt the elder pointed at Britt the much elder. "You're here, you're fine, and you're me in the future. The fact that you exist is all the testing we need. You prove that what I plan to do must work, or else you wouldn't be here."
Britt the much elder said, "No, that runs counter to the reasoning you used to get me involved in this mess to begin with. You're glitching out. You're part of the program. Thus, the program is glitching out, which means that me being here proves nothing and all bets are off. You're only trying to use me as proof because you want to mess with your code and you're looking for an excuse."
"Yeah,"
Philip agreed.
"Or she's not you, just a kind of placeholder copy of you the program created for you to interact with, and your fate isn't tied to hers, just like I've said all along."
"No," Britt the much elder said. "That's even more stupid. I guess it could be argued that my existence might prove that at some point somebody will do something to fix the glitch and it will work. That doesn't mean that it's you, Britt. Or that it's your idea, or involves Jimmy's idea at all."
"Hey," Jimmy said, "none of this was my idea. I want that clear. I had no idea."
Philip said,
"I'll vouch for that."
Britt the elder thought for several seconds. When she finally broke her silence, she spoke slowly and quietly, giving the same sense of a barely contained catastrophe as a profoundly drunk person driving 10 miles per hour under the speed limit in a ruler straight line.
"Okay. You all said we'd need lots of careful testing before you'd feel comfortable proceeding. What exactly would this careful testing look like?"
Philip said,
"We could test on animals. I wouldn't feel great about it, but we get, I don't know, an elephant or something. Something well known for its memory, and mess with its entry."
Jimmy pointed at Philip with both hands.
"Top man, I like it. Not only could we experiment with the animal's memory, But we could try to replicate the glitch to begin with. Not with the elephant, but like a rat or something. If we can replicate the problem, maybe we can come up with a better solution than memory replacement. Normally, I'm not a fan of animal experimentation. But this is to save the entire world.
Philip said,
"Not a fan of animal experimentation. You experimented on the code of hundreds of people."
"Yeah, and I saw the consequences of my actions and learned my lesson."
Britt the Elder stood up. "Wait a minute. How long do you think all of this experimenting will take?" She pointed at her thigh.
"Need I remind you that our time is limited? I'd have already spent a few years fixing this myself, then come back in time to give myself the antidote without bothering all of you if I didn't have a ticking time bomb working its way up my legs."
Britt the Much Elder said, "We could put you in slow time, like you did to Philip to bring him here. That'd give us years to come up with a fix."
"While I stand there like a statue, waiting for you three to figure out a way to save me? No thanks."
Philip said,
"Look, we're all kinds of worked up. I think we should knock off for the day. We'll all go sleep on it, come back tomorrow, and hopefully one of us will have thought of something we can all agree to, okay?"
Jimmy said,
"Fine by me."
Britt the Much Elder nodded.
"Britt, fine," Britt the Elder said, and disappeared.
Jimmy swiveled his desk chair to face Britt the Much Elder.
"I assume that if she comes back tomorrow and still wants to run experiments on her own memory, we're going to put her in slow time against her will?"
Britt the Much Elder said, "Absolutely." Philip wanted to argue against the idea, but the best reason not to do it he could come up with was,
"She won't like that."
Britt the Much Elder shrugged. "No, but it's the right thing, and she'll see that in time. If the roles were reversed, she'd do the same to Britt the Younger in a heartbeat."
"Yes,"
Philip agreed.
"And Britt the Younger would be furious at her for it."
Britt the Much Elder said, "Yes, and they'd both be in the right." 20. Martin materialized, standing straight and tall with a triumphant smile on his face, which faded quickly when he dropped 2 feet and landed in several inches of wet concrete. He bent at the knees and hunched over, swinging his free arm wildly to keep his balance while leaning heavily on his staff. He managed to keep from falling down into the gray mush, but his shoes and the hem of his already tattered robe were covered. Martin swiveled his head, taking in his surroundings. At first he thought he had accidentally transported somewhere he'd never been, but soon he realized that this was the main room of Gary's living space at Skull Gullet Cave. It only looked different because all of the furniture had been removed, the entire kitchen area had been demolished, and the floor was awash in a uniform layer of wet concrete. In the center of the living room, directly under the spot Martin had teleported into, was some sort of broad, shallow pit that had been sectioned off with wooden forms, with a separate pool of wet concrete at the bottom of the lower section. Martin pulled out 1 foot, looked at his ruined shoe, and shouted,
"Gary!"
The door that led to the antechamber opened. Gary leaned through the doorframe without stepping into the room. Behind Gary, Martin saw all of Gary's furniture arranged awkwardly around the stone pedestal. An episode of This Old House was playing soundlessly on the TV, green letters spelling mutes superimposed over the top left corner.
"Hey, Martin, how's it going?"
Martin stomped his foot down, deliberately splashing it in the wet concrete.
"You cleared the entire room, filled it with concrete, and lowered part of it just to get us to fall in?"
Gary glanced around the empty room.
"Us? I only see one of you." "The rest are coming!"
"Excellent," Gary said, and leaned against the doorframe, waiting for the show to begin. Only a few seconds later, Gwen materialized in midair, where the floor level had been before, holding her wand in one hand and a bundle of silver fabric in the other. She fell 2 feet, landing with a splash in the concrete. Martin rushed forward to hold her up, but stopped when it became obvious that she didn't need his help. Gwen looked down at her feet, then up at Martin with a smile on her face.
"He got us this time."
"Looks like it,"
Martin said. Gwen turned to Gary and said,
"Well done."
Then turned back to Martin and said,
"Hi."
"Hi."
Gwen smiled, and Martin smiled back, uneasily.
When Gwen seemed happy to see him, it made Martin happy. When she seemed unhappy to see him, it made him unhappy.
When she went from looking unhappy to see him to looking happy to see him with no explanation for the change, it made him profoundly uncomfortable. Gwen held the bundle of silver fabric forward.
I made this for you. It's a new robe.
Martin took it.
Thanks! That's great! I'll put it on later, when I'm not standing in wet concrete.
Tyler appeared, far enough to the side that one of his feet was over the pit. His left foot touched down on the upper level while the right half of his body kept falling, finally stopping when his right foot hit the bottom of the pit. Normally, he'd have hopped to the side to regain his balance, but the wet concrete prevented this. Instead, he fell over sideways, twisting on the way down and landing flat on his back, as if he intended to make a concrete angel. He seemed poised to unleash a torrent of profanities, but Gwen smiled down at him and greeted him with a cheerful,
"Hi, Tyler. Looks like Gary saw us coming this time."
She extended a hand to help him up.
"Yeah,"
Tyler said, taking her hand.
"Looks like it, I guess. Gwen, good to see you. You seem good."
"Yeah."
As he came to his feet, Tyler looked at Martin, who held up his new robe, still folded, for Tyler to see.
"She made me a new robe."
"Oh, nice. So you two have made up?"
Martin smiled.
"I guess?"
Gwen said,
"We'll talk about it."
Martin's smile dimmed. Roy and Jeff appeared at the same moment. Jeff materialized in the empty space over the sunken area and immediately fell in. Roy appeared on the higher portion of the floor and sunk into the concrete slowly, while cursing. Martin said,
"I hope you're satisfied, Gary."
"I am. I really, really am. It makes me wish I'd done this on purpose.
I'm just having the floors redone. That hole you're all wallowing in is going to be my new conversation pit."
Gary shouted,
"Foreman!"
Banging, creaking, and sounds of human exertion became audible as one of the doors down at the end of the hall opened. Hubert leaned out of the door, wearing a hard hat and waders with his tuxedo coat.
"Beastmaster!"
"I'm afraid my idiot friends have messed up the floors in here. You and the boys will have to come refloat it in the conversation pit."
"I see what you mean, Master. We're on the way!"
The wizards all levitated into the air and gravitated to the outer edge of the room as 13 dirty, undernourished young men in hard hats, rubber boots, and matching black t-shirts printed with an illustration of a tuxedo jacket, white shirt, and bow tie flooded out of the hallway and into the main room, their feet caked with wet concrete. They used flat boards and planks of wood to smooth out the tortured concrete while Gary stood in the doorway and shouted directions.
"That's it! Be careful, apprentices! The concrete flows like the currents of magic. It obeys its own laws, but with skill and patience you can guide it into the form you wish."
"Oh, Lord,"
Tyler moaned.
"He's doing a Karate Kid."
"What's a Karate Kid?"
Hubert asked as he dragged a straight plank across the surface of the concrete. Gary said,
"It's an ancient and legendary teaching technique invented by a great magician called Miyagi."
"Did he teach you, Master?"
"In a way, he taught us all, Hubert. How's progress on the seductorium?"
"Work on your bedroom is going well, Master. We've completed a mirror-lined posing platform. We've moved on to pouring the floor."
"Very good. Apprentices, remember, as you swing your hammers, the motion is quite similar to the motion one uses when wielding a wand. So watch your form, and try not to bend the nails. It's wasteful and looks amateurish. And I'd better not catch anyone writing their names in the floor in there."
Jeff muttered, "Concrete floors in the bedroom? Doesn't sound very seductive." Gwen shook her head.
"None of it does."
"The finished floors won't be concrete," Gary explained. "They're just laying down a nice flat slab. Later, they'll install the shag carpet."
Tyler absent-mindedly stroked his chin.
"I've always wondered, do they call it shag carpet because of how it looks, or because of what the owner hopes to do on it?"
Gary smiled.
"Can it be both?"
"It can,"
Gwen said, sadly. The apprentices worked their way backward down the hall, leaving a trail of perfectly flat concrete in their wake, until they finally disappeared back into the rooms in which they'd been working before. The wizards floated through the door to Gary's ceremonial antechamber and lowered themselves to the floor. Tyler rounded on Gary.
You put them to work remodeling your house?
Yeah, Gary said. They wanted to do something, so I gave them something to do.
They're expecting you to teach them magic.
I'll let them all expend some energy, then I'll give them some sort of test to see if they have the gift or something. They'll all fail, and I'll send them back out into the world.
When?
When they finish the remodel. And the yard work I'm planning.
Jeff asked, there isn't a door to the outside from your bedroom, is there?
No.
Then how are your apprentices going to get out without ruining the concrete themselves? Gary said,
I'll just levitate them out. It'll be a valuable lesson for them in the need to plan ahead.
You just came up with that now, didn't you?
Roy asked.
Yes, which is a valuable lesson in the importance of being able to improvise.
But why live in a home that was banged together by a bunch of amateurs when you can just make anything you want with magic?
The things we make with magic are just copies of things that were probably mass-produced to begin with. Sure, things that were made by hand have flaws, but they also have character. They have soul.
These aren't craftsmen, Roy said. They're untrained medieval peasants. The stuff they make will be nothing but flaws.
So they'll have that much more soul.
Gwen stared at Gary in obvious disbelief.
Wait a second. Since when do you care about this kind of thing?
Since always, Gary said. There's more to me than heavy metal and practical jokes.
Yeah, Tyler said. There's chasing women.
Unsuccessfully, Martin added.
And a love of handcrafted woodworking. You might have known if any of you had ever bothered to ask, or to even look around when you visit and think about what you see. Why did you think I had a book by George Nakashima on my shelf?
Gwen said I never noticed, because the bookcase was made of cinder blocks and plywood.
Martin said, okay, we've gotten off track here. We can discuss Gary's remodel later, when it's done and looks like crap. I called you all here because an apology is in order.
Gwen crossed her arms.
Yes?
Yes,
Martin said. They all stood in silence for a moment. Gwen said,
We're waiting.
So am I, because you're the ones who owe me the apology. I told you that Philip was being attacked and you didn't believe me. You all acted like I was crazy. Well, I ask you, who's crazy now?
Martin pulled out and flipped open the small silver box in which he carried his smartphone. He jabbed at the screen a few times, then pointed his staff at the far side of the stone ceremonial chamber. The future version of Philip appeared, standing with slumped shoulders, his staff barely hanging from his fingers. Martin turned back to the group.
See?
Tyler said,
It's Philip. Hi, Philip.
Future Philip remained motionless, except for his right hand, which he slowly waved.
Martin said, No, it isn't Philip. I mean, well, obviously it is Philip, but it isn't really, not our Philip. This is Philip from the future. Look how beat down and wrung out he looks. Our Philip would never leave the house looking that pitiful.
Future Philip glared at Martin.
I don't know, Roy said. Maybe that's just from listening to your blather.
Martin said,
I caught him red-handed. If I didn't have him trapped, he'd escape right now. Show them how you're trapped.
Future Philip breathed out, deflating noticeably, then pressed his free hand against the invisible wall of his prison. He asked Martin if that was good enough, but no sound came out of his mouth.
Cool!
Gary gasped.
Like a mime!
Martin said, Right? I'm also working on a defensive weapon that forces people to walk into a heavy wind. Gwen stared at Martin.
You've tried to convince us that you're not crazy by imprisoning your best friend?
I can prove that this isn't our Philip. He stole Philip's Fiero and buried it under a haystack out behind Philip's office.
Is that really proof?
Gary asked. Tyler mulled it over.
Well, I think we'd all agree that no sane man would steal a Fiero.
Future Philip stopped glaring at Martin and started glaring at Tyler.
The real question, Tyler continued, is if Philip's Fiero is under this haystack, did Philip do it? There's no reason to believe you didn't do it yourself, Martin. You seem intent on tormenting Philip.
I'm the one trying to help Philip,
Tyler pointed at the captive future Philip, who threw up his hands as if to say,
I know, right?
Martin said,
He's the one messing with Philip, and he's the one who took the Fiero. Go look. If you go back in time to 6 o'clock this morning, you can watch him do it.
Roy and Jeff disappeared, were gone for a little less than 5 seconds, then reappeared.
Martin's telling the truth, Jeff said. We watched this Philip steal the Fiero, drive it out, and bury it in hay.
All of the wizards turned and looked at future Philip. Gwen asked,
Okay. What do you have to say for yourself?
Future Philip shrugged and leaned back on the wall of his invisible prison, reminding them that he couldn't speak if he wanted to. Martin touched the end of his staff to the force field surrounding Future Philip and said,
Unmute.
Future Philip said,
I expect you want me to thank you.
We just want an explanation, Gwen said.
Future Philip allowed himself to slide down the wall until he sagged in a seated position, like a wilted potted plant that hadn't received enough water.
It pains me to no end to say this, but Martin is right. Everything he's told you is more or less accurate. But what he's left out is that I've been trying, despite Martin's interference, to prevent a terrible catastrophe.
What? Jeff asked. Future Philip said,
I can't tell you.
If you tell us, we can help.
No, you can't.
Martin said,
So think about it. He says he's here to prevent a tragedy, but he won't tell us what it is and won't allow us to help. He seems to think it's something only he can fix. And for the life of me, I can't imagine what that would be or why he wouldn't tell us. Logically, I think either he's trying to prevent something that we wouldn't consider a tragedy, or the thing he has to do to prevent this mysterious tragedy is something we wouldn't approve of.
Like what? Gary asked.
I don't know. And the Philip of tomorrow, today, here, won't tell us, will he?
Future Philip shook his head.
Martin said,
It was a waste giving you back the ability to speak.
21. Philip materialized in the same alley in Atlantis from which he'd teleported, facing the same dead-end wall he'd faced when he left. 10 minutes had passed in Atlantis. For Philip, it had been hours. First spent listening to Jimmy lecture him and the two elder Brits about the file, then trying to talk Brit the Elder out of acting on what Jimmy had told them.
Okay, Philip. Remember, it's still morning here. You've been out for a brisk walk. You need to get Nick some salt and then get home to spend the day with Brit the Younger. Well, that'll be good. Besides, after the day I've had, a quiet afternoon with a woman I love sounds lovely.
Philip spun around, took one step, then jumped straight up in the air and let out a frightened yelp. Brit the Younger stood blocking the alley's exit. Her mouth slowly spread into a big, toothy smile. The back of Philip's mind ruminated on the interesting fact that evolution has caused us to make an expression when we're happy that's similar to the face all mammals make when they're about to bite something. The look in Brit's eye left no doubt as to the intent behind this smile. It would have been frightening enough had she been alone, but standing behind her just to the side, peering over her shoulder, there was another her. A second Brit the Younger, wearing the same clothes, her hair styled identically. The only difference was that the Brit in back had a notebook, a pen, and a video camera on a tripod pointed directly at Philip, its record light glowing red. In a voice that sounded as if she already knew the answer and didn't like it, the Brit in front asked,
Where have you been, Philip?
Why are there two of you?
Philip asked.
Never mind that, the Brit in front said. It's part of an experiment. She's just here to observe.
The Brit in back scribbled down notes at a furious pace, with a furious look on her face.
What experiment?
Philip asked.
The front Brit said, Don't change the subject. Where were you, Philip?
I can't—
You can't tell me?
The front Brit interrupted. Why not?
I already know, so really, you might as well tell me.
You do? Then why ask?
She doesn't know yet.
The front Brit pointed over her shoulder with her thumb at the Brit in the rear, who took a moment away from her frantic note-taking to scowl at Philip. Behind her, Philip saw that the sound of tense voices had caused a bit of a crowd to start gathering behind the two Brits.
I'd rather not
discuss it here.
As the word here came out of her mouth, the front Brit started nodding slowly, her lips barely moving as if she was counting to herself. Philip started to step around her to his right, but she muttered, "Five," and stepped a block in before he barely lifted his foot from the ground. Not that it mattered. The sound of voices engaged in relationship drama had started to draw the inevitable crowd. Even if he'd been able to get past the Brits, a thick gaggle of onlookers blocked his escape. Philip stepped back in shock. He saw that both Brits were now counting to themselves, but their rhythms were slightly off. The Brit in the rear noticed this too and looked at the back of front Brit's head. Philip tried to step around them to his left. As he shifted his weight, the Brit in the rear grunted, 11. The Brit in front's eyes grew wide, and she lurched to the side to block Philip's exit. The rear Brit said, "There's that timing issue you mentioned. I was at 10. Even when I knew to look out for it, my count was slow. Yeah, that's definitely something we'll need to address." The rear Brit made a note. Then both of them turned to glare at Philip as if even their timing problems were his fault. Philip said,
"We're making..."
The front Brit said, "A spectacle of ourselves, and you'd rather discuss this in private." "Yeah, fine, whatever. We've got everything we need." She turned around, put a reassuring hand on the rear Brit's shoulder, then disappeared. The rear and now only remaining Brit clicked her pen, tucked her notebook under her arm, and collapsed her tripod. Philip said,
"I'll carry your tripod for you if you like."
Brit said nothing. Every man in earshot cringed. Every woman who heard smirked knowingly. Brit picked up her own tripod and stepped to the side, motioning for Philip to lead the way. The citizens parted, creating a narrow passage for Philip to walk through. Brit followed. All eyes stared at Philip, but nobody said a word to him. Behind him, he heard women whisper encouragement to Brit the younger as she passed. He walked in silence to Brit's front door, which he held open for. She didn't thank or even look at him as she entered. Philip took one last glance across the street to verify that it was not his imagination. Everybody was staring at him. He stepped into the apartment and closed the door behind him. Brit stood in the middle of the room, her arms folded, glaring. Nick leaned into the room.
"Oh good, you're both back. I see you caught up to him, brr."
He trailed off as he saw Brit's body language, fell silent, and also glared at Philip. Philip whined,
"Oh come on, Nick, you don't even know what this is about."
Nick said nothing. Brit asked, "What is this about, Philip?"
"Nothing!"
Brit stared at him.
"Nothing bad!"
Brit continued staring. Philip started talking, stopped himself, tried again, stopped again, thought for a moment, said,
"Okay, look."
Then fell silent. Brit said, "I asked you a question out there, and you said that you'd answer it if we weren't in public." Philip reran the conversation in his mind. He remembered her asking him where he had been and him replying that they were making a spectacle of themselves, not that he would say in private. Philip said,
"Technically, I said..."
But the look on Brit's face after he said technically stunned him back into silence. "Please don't make me ask you again, Philip." Philip sagged.
"Brit, I hope you know how important you are to me, and that I always have your best interests at heart."
"I liked to think so." Philip tried his best to speak clearly, while wincing.
"Then I hope you'll understand when I tell you that, for your own good, I can't tell you where I went."
For a full 10 seconds, the only sound in the apartment was the faint rustling noise caused by the scraping of Nick's tunic against his neck, as he shook his head in disgust. Brit said, "You won't tell me."
"I can't."
"Fine. I didn't want to have to do this, but I'll just go ask Brit the Elder. She'll remember what this was all about."
"No!"
Philip blurted.
"Don't go ask Brit the Elder. I mean, you shouldn't. What I'm saying is, she won't be able to,
You were with Brit the Elder, weren't you?"
"You... we would probably be unhappy about that, if it were the case, wouldn't you?"
Philip asked. "Philip, are you having an affair with Brit the Elder?"
"What? No, I could never. The idea wouldn't even occur to me. Brit, how can you ask me that?"
"I should be enough for you, Philip."
"You are."
"One of me."
"One is."
"Which one?"
"Oh, come on, you are. You!"
He pointed at her.
"This you, the only you."
Brit the younger remained motionless, studying Philip. "It wouldn't even occur to you to have an affair with Brit the Elder?"
"No!" not in a million years.
Why not? Do you find her unattractive?
Philip gaped at Britt. He turned to Nick and saw no support, just genuine interest in Philip's answer on his face. Philip thought furiously for several seconds before finally saying,
"There's no right answer to that question."
Britt the Younger said, "That was the wrong answer."
"Britt, you're asking me if I find a person who you believe is you attractive."
"Yes, Philip, she is me, but she's also my worst enemy."
"I know the feeling."
"This isn't funny, Philip. If I can't trust you, then this relationship's over."
"Apparently not," Philip said, "since you seem to believe I'm having some sort of relationship with you in your future, which, by the way, I'm not, so perhaps we are through after all, for, I might add, no reason."
"So you admit she's me?"
"No, never! Which is why it would be cheating if I got involved with her. And that's why I would never, ever even consider it. That's all I'm saying. I would never cheat on you with anybody, even someone you think is you."
"I want to believe you, Philip."
"I want you to believe me, too."
"So where were you?"
"I want desperately to tell you. I really do. But I can't."
"Why not?" Philip looked at the floor.
"Britt the Elder thinks it would be dangerous for you to know."
"Not as dangerous as it is to not tell me," Philip said.
"Look, I want to tell you. Now that you know I've been sneaking away, I can go to Britt the Elder and make the case that it's impossible to keep this from you anymore. I'll go talk to her, and I'll figure out a safe way to tell you what's going on."
Britt said, "Fine. But the fact that you need help thinking of a way to tell me without endangering yourself doesn't give me confidence." Philip said,
"Not safe for me. I'm afraid that ship has sailed. Safe for you, and her, and everybody else. Okay?"
Britt the Younger stared at Philip for a moment and let out a disgusted grunt. "Fine. Go talk to Britt the Elder. I have to go look over my notes and memorize my lines so I can jump back in time and go confront you in the alley again." She stormed off to her bedroom and slammed the door behind her. Philip turned to Nick, hoping to see or hear something, anything, that might make it better. Nick asked, "Philip, did you get me the salt I asked for?" Philip grimaced. Nick shook his head and walked out without saying another word. 22. Martin sat on the couch in the converted warehouse he called home, brooding on the confusing problem it seemed only he could solve. Across the room, an episode of the early 2000s reboot of Battlestar Galactica played on the TV. In this episode, Edward James Olmos as Commander Adama was brooding on a confusing problem that it seemed only he could solve. The show fit Martin's mood perfectly. Sensing motion out of the corner of his eye, Martin turned his head and watched as Gwen materialized. The two of them looked at each other for a moment, waiting for the other to speak so they could get an idea of the overall tone of the coming conversation. After several seconds of silent staring, they both had all too clear a picture of the tone, so Martin just went ahead and spoke up.
"Hey.
Hey.
Have a seat."
Gwen sat at the far end of the couch, as far away from Martin as she could possibly be, while still sitting on the same piece of furniture. They both watched the TV long enough to see Colonel Ty tell Commander Adama that they were in a terrible mess this time. Gwen asked,
"Okay, Martin, what's up with you?"
"What's up with me is that I've repeatedly asked you and all of our friends for help, and you all treated me like I was crazy or stupid, or maybe both."
"I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about you and me. You haven't called me in days, Martin. Why not?"
"I have called you, repeatedly, to ask you for help, remember? You treated me like I was crazy or stupid or both."
"No, you didn't call me, you called everybody. I want to know why you haven't called just me."
"Why? So you can mock me solo, without all the competition?"
"No, so we can talk about how we left things."
"Oh, that."
"Yeah, that. So, why haven't you contacted me?"
"Probably the same reason you haven't contacted me."
"That's..."
Gwen paused a moment before continuing, relaxed and in a softer voice.
"A good point. You're right. I could have called you just as easily."
Martin nodded.
"Okay," Gwen said. "So I'm calling you now. in person. Let's talk about it. I'm happy to, but I don't know that there's much more for me to say. I told you that I'm not proposing to you yet, but that I do expect to propose to you. You didn't say one way or the other how you felt about that, which sort of told me where you stand anyway. See that, Martin? There's part of the problem. You're making an assumption. You assume that me not saying anything means I don't want to marry you. Doesn't it? No, it doesn't. It doesn't mean that you don't want to marry me? No. Martin squinted. If I'm counting all the don'ts, doesn'ts, and no's correctly, you're saying that you do want to marry me, or at least you're not against marrying me someday. That's right. Maybe. Someday. Thank you, Gwen. At some point in the future, you might make me the happiest man in the world. Martin, I like the idea of marrying you, but before we get serious about that, there's another conversation we need to have, and I'm not looking forward to it. Well, let's have it now, because if we don't, I'll live my life dreading that conversation, and I don't know what it is. Okay. Gwen pulled her feet up onto the couch, then turned to face Martin. I want to have kids. Martin smiled. So do I! No more than three, though. Agreed, totally. I was thinking two. Cool, I'm fine with that. There, that wasn't so bad. That wasn't the conversation, Martin. That was just the lead-up to the conversation. Oh. Okay. Martin swallowed hard and asked, What else? Gwen said, I want us to be good parents. Well, I'm not against that. So far, so good. That means doing what's best for the kids, even if it's not what I personally want. I understand. I've thought about it, and I don't want to raise our kids in medieval England. Oh, okay. I see why you were nervous about this. Asking someone to move is a big deal. But, Gwen, I think I could be happy living in Atlantis. I don't think we should raise them in Atlantis either. It's just, I want our kids to be normal, happy children. If we raise them in Ledchurch, Camelot, or Atlantis, they won't be normal. I don't want to raise all-powerful god children. Star Trek has shown us how that works out, and it isn't good. We wouldn't give them powers until they were old enough to handle it, Gwen. But we'd still have ours. Instead of being able to create anything they want for themselves, they can get their parents to give them anything they want. Reality TV has shown us how that works out, and again, it isn't good either. What are you saying, Gwen? I'm saying that I think the only way for us to raise well-adjusted children would be to move back to our original time and not use our powers. You're asking me to choose either a package deal of magic, time travel, unlimited wealth, and immortality, or you? Yes, but only for a while. We could limit ourselves while we're raising them, then tell them the deal when they turn 21. Look, Martin, it's a big decision, and I don't want you to rush into it. You think about it for a while and get back to me, okay? Before Martin could respond, Gwen disappeared. A thousand thoughts swirled in Martin's head at once. But he was certain of one thing. He needed to go to the bathroom. He stood up, stepped around the edge of the couch, stopped, shouted several very loud obscenities, then asked, You heard all of that, didn't you? In the corner of the room, sitting in his invisible prison, future Philip smiled and nodded vigorously. Philip materialized in Britt the Elder's home. Britt the Elder had instructed him to teleport directly into the house for the time being to avoid suspicion, for all the good it had done them. Still, he felt self-conscious about barging into her domain in this manner, and made a point of appearing right by the entrance, as it felt to him like the closest thing to being outside he could manage while still technically being inside. He called out, Hello? He heard no answer. Just a strange, distant, wavering, high-pitched whine he couldn't quite identify. Hello? Still no response. Normally, Philip would have simply assumed that she was somewhere else, or didn't want to be disturbed. But something made him uneasy. It may well have been the weird noise. The more he heard it, the less he liked it. Focusing on the sound for even a second caused the hairs on the back of his neck to stand up. Philip walked slowly toward Britt's office. One could have described what he was doing as sneaking, if he hadn't continued shouting friendly-sounding greetings as he went. Hello, Britt! It's me, Philip! Are you home? Through the partially open office door, Philip could see that the office lights were off, but the room was illuminated in the bluish glow that in real life told one that a TV or computer monitor was on.
and in films meant that something awful was about to happen. Philip gently pushed the door open. The high keening noise got slightly louder. Britt the Elder's classic Macintosh sat on the desk, its monitor casting light on the empty space where her office chair usually sat. The volume of light and the direction of the shadows told Philip that the Mac was not the only source of light in the room. He craned his neck to the right and saw a second computer, a more modern desktop PC, with a flat panel monitor and cheap factory-furnished keyboard and mouse